a public hearing on Senate Bill 334B relating to student assistance, and I'm going to turn it over to Legislative Fiscal, Mr. Steve Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today, you have before you Senate Bill 334B, which is the bill that is designed to allow the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to implement changes to the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program that are known or have been called the implementation of the shared responsibility model. This bill comes to you, unusual, I think, for policy bills in that it has already gone to one of the floors. This bill did pass in an earlier version of the Senate unanimously. It then went to the House and is before you today to resolve a number of fiscal issues that remain in the bill that we will go over. One of the major fiscal issues in the bill is that there's considerable uncertainty as to how much any particular structure of this shared responsibility model will end up costing. And it is proven to proceed with the expectation that there may not be enough money appropriated to fund the model as it was presented to you. The fiscal questions then become, how should the state, in particular the agency, react if it does indeed turn out that funding is less than is needed to implement the model as they had planned? And what latitudes do you want to give to the commission, and what parameters do you want to set as the legislature determine the public policy of the state? So, if I may, there are only three handouts that I've distributed to you today. And the first, the one that I'd like to start off with before the chair asked me to go through this before the testimony was taken to set the background, is to look at the item that has the yellow covered sheet on the top. And this is just to set the background. There are a number of issues to look at. First of all, to explain what the proposed shared responsibility model is, and then also to explain what's in Senate Bill 334B, because these two, as we'll see, are not identical issues. What's in 334B is related to the shared responsibility model, but it does not specifically set everything that is planned to be done with this implementation. So if I may, if there aren't any questions before I begin, I'd just like to go through this page very quickly, actually. It won't take long, even though it has a lot of words, to discuss what is happening, how the opportunity grant works currently, what the proposed model changes are to the opportunity grant, what Senate Bill 334B actually does and does not do, and then how you've been told the model is planned to be implemented, and see how that relates to Senate Bill 334. So, what is the opportunity grant? The Oregon Opportunity Grant is the state's primary student financial aid program. It's a grant program, which is to say that students are not required to repay any of the funds that they receive under the Oregon Opportunity Grant. It's available to students, to Oregon resident students who attend Oregon public or not-for-profit private colleges and universities. So if you're an Oregon student and you go out of state, you're not eligible. If you're an out-of-state student in an Oregon institution, you're not eligible. It is only for Oregon residents in Oregon institutions. The grant is need-based. That is to say, students with incomes below certain maximum levels are eligible to receive the grant. And that's what you have to do to qualify. You also have to attend at least half-time to receive the grant. That's a change. This is the first year that you could get a grant by being less than a full-time student. But now you have to be at least a half-time student in order to get a grant. If you want to see what the income limits are, I would refer you to the green sheet. The green sheet is printed on both sides, but the side that's on the landscape side shows you what the income limits are. If you're wondering how these particular why these are the particular income limits, these are not set in statute. These are determined by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And the Oregon Student Assistance Commission has established these particular income limits. We can talk more in depth, if we have time, about why they picked these numbers. But I did want to say that you can see that the limits vary by household size and by whether the student is independent financially of support from their family or not. We're now down to the fourth bullet item.
Representative Barnhart, is this appropriate time to ask a question about this, about the green sheet, or do you want to do that later?
As far as I'm concerned, it's appropriate, Mr. Chair.
Sure, Representative Barnhart. Thank you. I recall talking about dependent students and independent students, and so the numbers, the household size numbers make sense in that respect. What I don't understand is why the independent student two-person household has a different household income level than the dependent student two-person household does. And there's probably a very good reason for it. I just don't know what it is.
The technical reason, is I'm not going to give you the rationale for it, but I'm going to say tell you how these limits are established.
Thank you.
And if you look here at the bottom of this, on the same sheet that you're looking at, not the last line, but the two lines that are together, right above that, for independent students with dependents, so that's not the single person who doesn't have dependents. For independent students with dependents, these income levels are 50% of Oregon's median family income level for households of that size. For the line above that, I referred you to the wrong line. I'm sorry. For the line above that, which is sort of listed separately, for dependent students, the incomes represent 55%. Why there is a higher cutoff for the dependent than the independent, I'm sure there was a rationale why the commission did that. It escapes me right now. I know that part of these adjustments, these percentages, have been changed as funding levels have changed. But these are, all of these parameters that you see here, everything, basically everything you see here written, where you see a percentage, where you see a dollar amounts, these are determined by the commission. Also, the commission, under the current program, determines the amount of the awards, which are shown on the other side of this green sheet. Currently, the awards are, and these are what the awards will be, on the last column shows what they'll be in the first year of the biennium. You funded this in this Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget bill, which you've already passed out of the subcommittee and out of full committee as well. The award amounts are established again by the commission, and they are calculated to reflect 11% of the cost of full-time attendance. Now, if you look at these numbers, and for example, if you look at community colleges, $1,470, well, what is that 11% of? That's certainly not 11% of tuition. If it was, that would mean that the tuition would have to be $13,000 a year, and it's nothing like that at community colleges. What it represents is 11% of the cost of attendance, which includes not only tuition and fees, but also living expenses.
And books?
And books, yes. And those are costs of attending. But living expenses would include housing, food, that kind of thing. So these are the amounts. They vary. The amounts that you see here are for full-time students. Half-time students receive half the amounts. The lowest award amount that anyone would get would be if you are a community college student studying half-time, you would get $735 per year. Of course, it would be broken up by each quarter. So if you were, you would get a third of that each quarter that you attended, assuming you attended three quarters in an academic year. The highest award amounts would be for a full-time student at Reed College, who would get $4,956 I believe they're on a semester system, so they would get half of that in each of the two semesters at Reed College. The important thing to note here, and that I want to stress, is every student who is getting a grant at a particular institution gets exactly the same amount. If you get it, you get these numbers that you see here, either this amount or half of this amount if you're not full-time. I'm now at the part on the back on the yellow page where we're down to proposed shared responsibility model changes. So what's going to change?
Ms. Chairman. Senator Devlin, I did want to get one thing on the record relative to this, because we get into these questions, and we got into them before when we discussed this, is the bottom half of this page, it's for private institutions, obviously represents basically the state's cost per student. Obviously the portion on the upper portion of the page is the cost in terms of aid, but the state is actually also paying part of the additional cost. So I mean, it's in a sense, because sometimes people question why higher amounts are going to private. It, in a very real sense, is that this is the state's contribution towards that student. And I think the other portion of that is that if you actually look at where the money goes in terms of portions, this is the smallest portion in terms of number of students. Whose community colleges are the highest
in terms of
recipients of dollars?
Yeah.
Then the four-year publics and then the privates.
Do we know a percentage of the publics?
No, I can certainly get that information to you. I don't know if OSAC brought it with them. I did not bring that in here with me, so I can't answer that question now, but I can get back to you on that. The proposed shared responsibility model changes. First of all, the annual cost of the program as it exists now, so 2006-07, these award amounts in the middle column, these eligibility requirements limits are a little less for 06-07 because we just showed them for the 07-08. But that program costs about $32 million per year as it's currently configured. In the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget bill, which you already passed, Ways and Means expanded funding for the Opportunity Grant Program to $72 million per year. That's a 140% increase. And that's beginning only in the second year of the biennium. And when you did that in House Bill 5044, you didn't just do that. You told the commission that they are to implement the shared responsibility model in the second year of the biennium. And you further directed the commission that they should implement it in such a way that its costs do not exceed the $72 million you provided. So they're going to have to do some, they're going to have to do a lot of calculations and figure out what award levels will reasonably bring the awards not to exceed $72 million, but not undershoot too much. They don't want to provide less in awards than your appropriation would fund, and they're going to have to decide what to do if even their best estimates turn out to be a little wrong and they notice that the costs are really going to be more than $72 million. They're going to have to make some adjustment perhaps mid-year in order to keep the costs no more than $72 million. Those were the instructions you gave them. But the question still remains, well, what is this shared responsibility model that you directed them to implement for the second half of this biennium, of the next biennium? And I'm at the bottom bullet on page one. Really, the fundamental difference between the proposed shared responsibility model and the existing system is that under shared responsibility model, opportunity grant awards will vary with the student's income and ability to pay, so that it won't be the case now that every student who gets an opportunity grant in OUS and who's full-time will be getting $1,752. What the students get will vary. And it will vary by their income, by their ability to pay. That is the fundamental difference. Now, if you go to the next page, in order to stress this, the next thing to note is that the shared responsibility model does not result in any set award sizes for a particular student. So we know that award sizes are going to vary, but we don't know what student A is going to get or what student B is going to get. We just know that generally, if student A has a higher income than student B, generally they'll get a smaller award, but we don't know how much. And the reason why we don't know how much is because the amount of the award will vary with the settings of a number of parameters in the calculation. And the question that you'll be looking at, I think, is, do you have any preferences as to which parameters are used, how they are used? Do you want to have the commission make these decisions, or what? The governor, in fact, has revised some of these parameters a number of times since recommending the shared responsibility model. So it has not been a static model. It's not been a static set of parameters that have been proposed. Things have changed. Some of them have changed due to the funding level not being at the full amount that was originally requested, and some of them have changed due to revisions of what the proposal they would want it to do. We reported to you when you had the OSEC budget work sessions that we have concerns in LFO that the model used to forecast the costs is underestimating the cost. Okay? We're not only concerned that there's a large chance of it being inaccurate because it's a new program, but we think there's a bias and that the costs were being underestimated. And we believe that the proposed award levels would exceed the amount of funding that you are providing. Therefore, we think that the types of award levels that I'm going to be showing you here, which is based on the current proposal, we don't think there's going to be enough money to do that. Now, I do want to say that since the work session, OSAC and the governor's office continue to work on implementing this model, and they have expressed increasing confidence in the model's ability to forecast, which is good news. And hopefully it will turn out that maybe this model will be very accurate in the end. They've offered to discuss why they believe this with LFO, but we've this point in the session, we just haven't had time to really sit down and have those conversations. But again, we do think that it's important, or it would be prudent, to assume that there's a good possibility that there may not be enough money still, and hear from you as to what you would want the commission to do in that case. I'd now like to talk specifically about the bill, the be-engrossed version of the bill, as it comes before you, and what it does. I will say, first of all, that the be-engrossed version does not set the award amounts, which are on these large sheets, which are the award amounts that are currently being considered as likely or proposed. Okay? What the be-engrossed version does is it changes laws that authorize the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. It eliminates the current law that says that the awards must be amount to a uniform level equal to a percentage of a student's financial need, and it replaces that with what is essentially an equation. And the rest of page 2 and most of page 3 end up, the beginning of page 3 ends up coming to an equation, which is really shown on page 4. So page 4 is the last page. So what I would like to do in the interest of your time is just talk about what the equation is, and then we can go into more detail if there are any questions. And if you look at the very top of page 4, I didn't show 4 breakdowns, but at the very top before the first breakdown, a student's award under the opportunity grant, and this is defined by Senate Bill 334. Senate Bill 334 says a student's award must be equal to the cost of education minus what's known as a student share, minus what's known as a family share, minus what's known as a federal share. So you take the cost, you determine that the student should pay some, the family should pay some, and the feds should or will pay some, and whatever's left is what the student award amount is. What Senate Bill 334 does not do is it does not calculate or tell the OSAC what the dollar amount should be of any of those 4 items. Okay, so those 4 items that become part of the determination are not in the bill. So the question is, well, what does the bill tell us and what does the bill not tell us? And what the bill tells us, first of all, is the following. The first item, which is the cost of education, basically it says the bill requires that the cost of education include, but not be limited to, tuition, fees, and living expenses. Okay, so again, sort of similar. In fact, I think they use the same definition when we come to the end as OSAC currently has for cost of education. So it's tuition, fees, and living expenses. Okay, but what does that mean? Well, this is what it means in terms of the proposals as it's planned to be implemented. Again, none of these numbers are in the bill, but for full-time students at a four-year institution, if you look now on page 4, all of these first numbers in the equation are what the proposed amounts are. For full-time four-year students, the cost of education is assumed to be $15,516, at least in the model that's generating the numbers that we're using to indicate how much it costs. Again, this is broken down. The $15,516 is broken down into tuition and fees and living expenses. The amount of living expenses that's allowed for every student is the same. $9,805 is allowed for living expenses. The only thing that differs is the amount that's allowed for tuition and fees. For tuition and fees at community colleges, we're about just right around $3,200, and for four-year institutions, you're at $5,700.
Steve, I had a question. So did you just say that the living expense, regardless of where you are in the state of Oregon, the living expenses are assumed to be the same, or are configured at the same amount?
Under the bill does not indicate whether or does not require the commission to set a single living amount for every student. It does not require them to differentiate living expenses for students in different places. To the extent that that is an important public policy, you might want to change that and specify. In the simulation model, it is run based on $9,805 for every student. And so we assume, therefore, that that is the proposal that we're getting. I don't know if that is still the way that the plan is to implement this, but that's the information we've got.
Senator Bevel, just a clarification on that, too, that living expenses, that is a nine-month figure, is it not? It's not a, because they generally are planning financial aid over a nine-month period.
Yes.
So it's a nine-month period for living expenses.
And the details of this are on page 3, where it says proposed parameters. So it's $9,800 for living expenses, $3,200 for tuition if you're at a community college, tuition and fees, or $5,700 if you're at OUS or a private four-year institution.
So can I? I'm kind of confused about this page with the equation on it.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers, the two numbers that are in brackets are the cost of the education minus the student share.
Exactly.
Okay, why is there full-time four-year on the top and full-time four-year on the bottom?
That is supposed to be, thank you for noting that error. I just copied the title without changing it. The bottom equation is actually part-time two-year. I apologize, but that is
part-time
what it
should two-year?
Yeah, so these are part-time students at community colleges.
Okay, I'm on board now.
Okay, thank you. So we've got the cost of education then, which has this $9,800 for everyone, whether you're full-time or part-time. Then you add the tuition, and the amount of tuition you add is the full amount of the tuition if you're full-time and only half the tuition if you're part-time. So that is why if you compare the full-time four-year with the part-time four-year, the difference, full-time four-year, their cost is $15,500. Part-time four-year, their cost is $12,600. The difference is you're taking only half the tuition, but you're still keeping the total living expense. The student share and the family share are the amount that the individual is and their family is expected to pay. And what the bill does is it basically sets the student share equal for all students, regardless of their income. It only depends upon where you're attending. The family share is the part that varies with your income. The student shares are shown here for the four types of students. And again, every four-year full-time student, wherever they go, has the same student share. Every full-year full-time community college student has the same student share. And those are the student shares. Those are the second numbers there. And the student share, the bill says the student share has to be based on a couple of things. It has to be based on how much you could reasonably earn, a student can reasonably earn, working for part-time. But it doesn't specify. So it doesn't specify how many hours a student has to work. It doesn't specify what wage rate you can assume a person can get. The commission can choose all of those. And the parameters we've been looking at, these are the amounts that are being chosen. There's also for students at four-year schools, an additional students are also expected to be willing, if necessary, to borrow a certain amount that's considered reasonable. And the amount that's considered reasonable to borrow, if I turn now back to page 3 at the bottom where it says the student's share, it's probably easiest to see it this way. The assumptions are that a full-time student should be able to earn $5,200 a year toward education expenses. A part-time student can earn $7,000 per year. And at four-year institutions only, students could reasonably be expected to borrow $2,750 if they're full-time and to borrow $1,375 for part-time students. That's how all of these student share numbers that you see on page 4 are calculated, because they're either directly the earnings amount, that's for the community colleges, or you add in the borrowing amount. Again, none of these particular numbers are in statute. To the extent that you believe that these numbers should be in statute and not the commission to choose, then you would need to amend the bill. Going back to page 4, you can see what the base amounts are for each of the four types of students before there's an adjustment made for the family share and the federal share. In theory, if a family was not expected to contribute anything and the feds weren't contributing anything, the maximum award amount for full-time four-year students would be $7,566. Now, under the proposal, there are a lot of students where the family share is zero. Families are not expected to contribute anything above the amount in the student share. But for these students, typically, if not always, they are eligible for federal monies, primarily the Pell Grant. So what we see is we don't see any awards that are really at $7,566, because for everyone, you're either getting federal money that's reducing that amount, primarily the Pell Grant, or your family, if you have too much money to receive the Pell Grant, well, by then the family is expected to contribute some.
May I ask a question of clarification? Mm-hmm. Can you refresh my memory, Mr. Bender? If the student gets scholarships, they go to underwrite the student share of the cost?
They do not change the student share. The student share are those four numbers that you see there after the minus sign in each case. So for a four-year student, the student share is $7,950. If the student is able to get a scholarship for whatever amount, it does not affect this calculation.
So that source of revenue is not considered anywhere in this computation?
I do not believe that there's any source in there for, it looks like Margie Lau has a comment, for, scholarships. I mean, certainly for something like the federal awards, like a Pell Grant, those are in there. But for scholarships.
Rush is coming up. Mr. Chairman, can I ask the question?
Yes.
It's very small. People finishing their Peace Corps service or finishing their service in AmeriCorps, would their education be considered part of their student share? for education, they get an education sort of like stipend at the end of their service.
Mr. Chair, the scholarship money that was referenced, for the record, my name is Martha Val, Governor's Office. The scholarships that Representative Morgan was referring to, as well as the stipends that Peace Corps students would have earned as educational vouchers, those all count towards the student share. So the way in which the program is conceived and structured, things that students have done via their own initiative to save funds while they're high school students or prior to enrolling, efforts that they've done to earn scholarships through either merit or other need-based types of private philanthropy, all of those count towards the student's share of the contribution.
So I want to ask another question, though.
Representative Morgan.
What happens if the student share is less than zero? What happens if they're netting money from scholarships and other sources?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, generally those private philanthropy organizations will change their awarding so that because students are not allowed to get more in awards than what their cost of attendance is. And that's something that the school financial aid office then has to adjust to reflect that.
Thank you.
I just had a question. I was a little confused by your response, Ms. Lau. If a student, if you have two students, and the only way that they differ in their circumstances is one of them has received a $1,000 scholarship and the other one is not, do their opportunity grant awards differ? Or not that they would be provided by the state or received from the state?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Bender, no, their opportunity awards would not change. What would change is the amount of effort the student would have to put into either work or borrowing.
Correct. So, in other words, the amount of the award is not impacted by a student's receipt of scholarships. Clearly, their financial situation is better at having received the scholarship. But the program does not essentially penalize students who get scholarships by reducing their opportunity grant by an offsetting amount or even a portion of that. On the other hand,
so the net result then is that it lowers the level of the student share. The student has to put less money in because they've received a scholarship to cover part of the student share costs.
Right, the cost to them will be less.
Ms. Law has a...
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, being the mom of one college student and one recently, in fact, she's going through graduation ceremonies this weekend, one recently graduated student, I can assure you that students who have gotten scholarship funds have absolutely worked really hard to earn those funds.
And I'm not trying to, I'm just trying to figure this out.
But what we want to do is we don't want to discourage that student's initiative mm-hmm. or the private sector philanthropy mm-hmm. that makes that possible.
Mm-hmm.
Just for identification, what about the instance in which, well, on the public side, if it was a fee remission and it wasn't performance-based, it was a fee remission, or on the private side, where some institutions actually know that they can't get students to come together in terms of available scholarships, federal aid, they give basically, I would say, some of them give non-academically based stipends to students so they're able to attend. Same thing almost as a fee remission, to be honest. Would those count towards the student's contribution?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, yes, those will. Okay. And one of the things that we've worked with the school financial aid offices to anticipate is that this is a formula-driven process where we're going to discern what the state contribution should be for these students. But there's an infinite number of variations in terms of student circumstances and needs. And so that's where the school's own resources from other federal resources or their own endowments and institution resources can be used to more tailor-make to fit specific circumstances that those students may face. Some students may not be able to put that amount of work in because of either the demands of the curriculum or the schedule or maybe the community in which the student goes to school in. There may not be enough employment opportunities for them to work the 12 or 14 hours a week that the program anticipates. So all of those need to be adjusted to reflect the school's circumstance.
Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Starr.
Thank you. I've got a more generalized question I think Mr. Binder perhaps can answer. And I guess back to the point that he made that LFO is concerned about the overall projections and the amount of money and whether it's all going to be equal at the end. This X amount of money taken by NEM, in the event that the applications for these grants exceed the amount of money that's available, is it the expectation that there will be basically a percentage, flat percentage across the board that everybody's grant would be reduced? So it hits the cap. Is that the expectation?
Senator, I think this is the big question here. There really isn't a specific, we don't know. And we don't, there's, the only direction that you gave was at this point in the budget bill, all you said was make adjustments so that the cost doesn't exceed this amount. And types of adjustments that could be made could be like your mentioning in your example, where all the award amounts are reduced either by the same amount, dollar amount, by the same percentage amount, or whatever. Another change could be that eligibility requirements could somehow be changed so that instead of award amounts being changed, there would be fewer students who would get the award. There are a number of options. Under the bill, as it comes to you, any of those are possible. And also, under the bill as it comes to you, as the bill, as opposed to your budget note, the commission doesn't have to do any of those things. The commission could just set off deadline, or could, for example, impose an application deadline and say, if you don't get your application in by such and such a date, you don't get it. The commission could do a number of things. And the question is, to what extent you wish to let them know what it is, how you'd want them to react in situations like this.
Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the risk of raising a topic that's already been discussed while I was at the Revenue Committee meeting, I'm wondering if one of the options that's being considered is some kind of limitation on the amount of the award relating to the maximum amount of awards at the public universities, if that's one of the items that's being discussed.
That is, the bill itself, again, would not address this issue. The proposal that was presented to you when you were looking at the OSAC budget was to make an adjustment to the family contribution, which we can get to next, that would have the effect of reducing award amounts by a greater dollar amount the more money you have. So in other words, if the commission didn't have enough money, people with the very lowest income levels would have no impact. The commission would not reduce their awards. As income levels went up, the amount of the award reduction would increase to the point where there would no longer be any funds available. That is only one of many possible ways of addressing the situation.
Mr. Chair, and I'm raising a different possibility. I don't know if it's already been discussed. And the possibility I'm raising, let me just give an example so that you can understand the question better. At the OUS system, the 0708 maximums, I understand it reading the green sheet, is 1752.
Correct.
I noticed that at most of the independent institutions, the maximum award is higher than that. I'm wondering if one of the issues that's been considered is limiting the maximum to some number that might be related to the amount of the maximum award at one of the public institutions.
Actually, that is one thing that the bill does do, in fact, and OSAC must follow it because it's in the bill.
What does that do?
It does say that the award levels, award calculations for individuals at the private institutions will be the same as the award amounts for individuals at OUS institutions.
Are these dollar amounts?
These are dollar amounts. Well, since every student might have a different dollar amount, the same student would get the same award amount whether they attended University of Oregon or any of the institutions that you see here as the independent level.
Well, then I'm confused because the maximum amounts here are very different.
Representative Bernhardt, this is the program as it exists currently. This is not...
As it exists for the first year of the biennium.
This is what happens when you miss part of the discussion. And thank you, Representative Morgan. I appreciate that, and I'll stop talking.
Okay. Representative Morgan partially clarified it. They'll continue the existing program for the first year of the biennium, which is what you see.
Yeah,
the second year biennium, everybody will be considered to have the same cost at a four-year institution in terms of the maximum cost.
Mr. Chairman, with just a little bit of clarification, the bill does have a grandfathering clause in Section 7, so students who are already enrolled in one of those schools would be basically redlined for their remaining years of eligibility. But incoming students would be computed under the new methodology.
If I could follow up just briefly. And the new methodology is as described here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, yes. Mr. Bender has pointed out some of the options that have been considered. The Governor's Office and the Commission and the Access and Affordability Work Group would recommend that we use what we call this progressive rationing tool using the expected family contribution as a multiplier against that. And that way, the more resources the family has, the more of a reduction they'd have if there's a resource shortfall.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I now understand, and I apologize for the interruption.
Is that Morgan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bender, this is a question for you. There appears to be disagreement between the governor's staff and LFO about the models' ability to predict reality. I'm wondering if LFO has any information for us about your estimation of the gap.
Yeah, I do think the first part of your statement is correct. And certainly, I think there were periods earlier when the governor's office was also concerned about the projections in the model, but apparently, as time's gone on, they've become more confident in the award, in the projections that the model are giving. Again, to explain why we have concerns about what the model is projecting, our concerns deal with the fact that in some cases, the model is projecting costs based on there being fewer full-time students receiving awards than our current opportunity grant program is already providing. And we know that this is a much more generous program. You've increased funding by 140%, and we know that the intent is certainly, among other things, to expand the model to serve more students, both part-time and full-time, in our current system. We are concerned because of the fact that the model is projecting, or the estimates are based on projections that show fewer full-time students in some cases than we already have in the system that we have now. We have assumed that, I think we had cases, if you look here, keep flipping through this set of materials, you'll come to a page that looks like this, that's labeled, that says Oregon Shared Responsibility. It has some shaded numbers. And if you go to the back of that page, some of these estimates here are me trying to figure out how much this thing would cost if we didn't have these reductions in the number of students from what we're currently experiencing. And this has been a fluid number, but approximately $20 million per year was the difference that we were thinking it might cost another $20 million per year. than was being projected. I would at this point prefer to say that we have concerns, but we don't have a very good, really, pricing number. We know that you have funded this program at $72 million. We know that the commission is directed to make the adjustments necessary to have a program that doesn't cost more than $72 million. We just believe still it will result in that the commission will have to, we will not be able to use the parameters that are anticipated, because they will find that that will cost too much money.
But still, if I might just clarify, LFO is pointing out that there may be as much as a $20 million funding gap in a $72 million program.
Yes.
Okay.
Ms. Chairman, just trying to get a handle on this. I mean, it's already been said that probably one of the principal choices either OSAC will have to make or would have to be done in statute would be whether to reduce the amount of grants, which I don't believe is the preferable, because it actually, if you reduce them across the board, you're actually making students that had a very limited capability of attending probably getting back to that situation that we talked about and not being able to attend. If you reduce the income levels of eligibility, obviously you're going to have fewer students. So I think those are the two sort of parameters that you have. But what about, I don't think it's been your practice, wouldn't you have to revert back to a window of eligibility in terms of a time to apply, rather than our existing opportunity grant, which you can apply for any time, or, I mean, if you're trying to control costs. And it's never been your practice, probably after awarding a grant, to change it mid-school year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, it has occurred where the Commission has very occasionally had to make a grant reduction mid-year, and that was usually because of a serious economic recession situation that the state faced, and the legislature disappropriated a part of the funds in order to rebalance the state's budget as a whole. It would definitely be preferable not to make a reduction. That's the reason why we're trying to be very cautious in the modeling work. The Student Assistance Commission, even this week, has run dozens of scenarios working now against this past year's total student file of federal financial aid applications. We've folded into it now as well the most recent decisions made by the State Board of Higher Education about what the cost of attendance will be for the coming year, and applied the same methodology. That cost has actually gone up above what we'd expected to be in the model. But to offset that, it's looking extremely encouraging that our friends in the federal government are going to increase the Pell Grants. And so they're almost offsetting adjustments between those two actions.
Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to
say that this is any way to overlook a $20 million potential problem, which many parties don't believe is that big. But the reality of this would be, since you're doing the opportunity grant for the first year and you're doing the new shared responsibility for the second year, I expect if we got in trouble, when we would get in trouble was as we were coming into session in 2009, because we would be dealing with the final two terms of that school year. So it's not much solace, but at least we would be here to deal with the problem.
Well, if I might, though, if we handle the problem in that way, we have no recourse but to either pull the carpet out from under students that have been expecting to be fully funded, or putting $20 more million or whatever on the table.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need a clarification of what our task is here today.
would be helpful. Because I'm unclear. This bill passed, the Senate arrived in the House, and the decision was to bring it back here for a second look. I'm not just sure what our second look should be. I have very grave concerns, as Representative Morton has stated, that we implement a program that winds up shorting students. So is there some clarification as to what we are about here?
Yeah, I think the idea, and I'm sure Steve could go into more, is the bill is largely silent in certain respects where there are potentially key policy questions, and to what extent does this committee believe that we should leave it up to OSAC to come up with answers, or versus, you know, to what extent do we as a committee and a legislature wish to kind of weigh in and be more kind of prescriptive? That's generally what we're doing, but you could probably more specifically say.
Mr. Chair, I think you stated excellently. I think that talking about students being shorted, it depends upon compared to what. The amount of funding is being increased by 140%. So most students will clearly be getting more money than they did under the existing program, under this new proposal. It would be shorted if there was a sort of an expectation given to students when they were deciding whether to enroll that they would receive X amount of dollars, and then it turned out that they did not get that. So I think that the issue is to what extent, what direction you want to give the commission to ensure that that doesn't happen, or to minimize the chance of that happening, and also to not, if the commission determines, as we hope that they would, what the cost, if they determine that there's a shortage, before they start indicating what the award amounts are going to be at all. So it's not a case where students think they're going to get a certain amount. If the commission determines in 3 months that, well, gee, the $72 million really can't give us the award amounts you see here, so we're not going to even tell people that. Instead, we're going to come up with a different set of award amounts before anyone hears about what we think they will be. The question is, is it your public policy to put any parameters on how the commission should make adjustments so that the award levels will indeed be what they think will be the cost of the program? So, you know, the question of the uncertainty we can find out even before anyone is told how much to expect that there isn't enough money, or we believe there isn't enough money. We could also find out, if possible, that the program isn't going to cost as much as people thought, and maybe we can have more generous award structure. It could go either way. But the question is, even if it happens before students are ever, and institutions are ever given notification of what these award amounts would be, what should you do? Or what should be done?
Just as a follow-up, did I understand that your concern also, Steve, is that fewer students will have access? Did I hear that?
I didn't mean to say that, no. I'm not sure what I said that gave that impression. That was not what I meant to say.
Well, if I might clarify, what I think that Senator Morse, please correct me if I'm not understanding this, but are you looking for what the moving parts are here?
Well, I'm concerned is that if you were to take this program and just the 140% increase in funding and said we're just going to continue that under the existing model, will you have fewer students under the shared responsibility model than you would under the current model?
I don't believe so.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think that there's any way that we would end up with fewer recipients with the expansion, and we're likely have more students who can actually take advantage of the opportunity because the grants will be sufficient that they can actually afford to go to school in the lowest income brackets. Right now, you know, we hear from students and families that they basically dismiss post-secondary education as even an option for them, and that happens very early, middle school age, for a lot of students. And, you know, this is really tied to what we're trying to do with the entire education continuum. We want students to be driven to achieve the new diploma requirements, and a part of the motivation for them to do that is for them to know that there is real opportunity for them after high school. So for lower income families, this is an important part of that continuum.
I think Steve had an aha moment on Senator Morse's question.
I'm Senator Morse. I apologize. Your question was very clear, and I just didn't track it correctly. I think that what you're referring to is I said that the model that is projecting the cost was showing that there would be fewer recipients under the shared responsibility model than under the existing opportunity program. Because we do not believe that that's really what would happen, that's why we're questioning what this model is saying the program would cost. We do not believe, as Ms. Lau was saying, that there would be fewer students who actually receive the awards. That's why we're concerned, and that's why we're talking about perhaps a $20 million underestimate on this model of what the cost will be.
So, if I may clarify more, say, potential short on tour is, one is engaged students with the expectation of a certain funding level that could be reduced given that gap, or you have fewer students, or and.
Yes, I mean, if it turns out that if it turns out that the award levels that are being proposed would cost $20 million more, or any amount more, than the $72 million that you've given to the commission for this program, they would have to decide whether what to do about that. And it could be reduction in awards, or it could be reduction in the number of students who would be eligible compared to what they had initially thought, even though even after that reduction, we could still end up with more students than under the Opportunity Grant program.
But there is Senator Walker had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Afternoon for coming to the meeting. I was looking at the bill, and we give a lot of discretion to the commission to do that. Go back to the bill, and it says the commission shall determine the state award, the commission shall determine the family share, the federal share. I think the commission is well placed to be able to do that, and I would be reluctant to have the legislature get its fingers in there trying to model with what the commission is well qualified to do and have that flexibility, because we don't have the flexibility as things change, but the commission surely does. So my support would be to leave it with the commission to make those decisions.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I don't know who is next.
Let's go to Representative Barnhart first.
Okay, Representative Barnhart.
And Edwin, and I'll go.
There is a limitation on the commission action, though, isn't there, based on the amount of money that's appropriated to pay for this?
Mm-hmm.
They can't spend more than that amount. Is that right?
They cannot spend more than that amount. And
so if there has to be an adjustment, that's a limitation that will if whatever formula they come up with would spend more than that, that becomes a limitation which would force them to make adjustments in whatever formula they were using.
It could require them to make adjustments in the formula, or it could require them to, for example, in the past when this has occurred, they have simply set off application cutoff date.
So they eliminate students. Yeah, but that would be a decision that they would have to make in order to stay within the appropriated amount.
For this bill, they certainly could not spend more money than you appropriated
right.
to them.
Mr. Chair, come forward and tell us what these
are. Yeah, I think Representative Morgan has a good point. If we can maybe have someone from the commission tell us what would happen in that.
Well, and as a matter of fact, just finish the thought very quickly. I think that lends support to the comments that Senator Walker raised a minute ago, and that's really essentially my comment,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
I think Representative Walker.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, if you might
allow Margie to answer the question of Representative Morgan.
There was. Did you have the question if there were insufficient monies?
The commission does not have the authority to overspend its budget. Their state laws that prohibit that. But in addition to that, any modifications that the commission proposes to make that are different than that which you're expected at the close of session, the bill does require the commission to report that back to either the Joint Ways and Means Committee or the Emergency Board prior to implementation of any of those changes in awards. So there is there's discretion on the part of the commission, but accountability to this legislative body so that no one is surprised at whatever the changes are in the circumstances that we're going to have to do. And that can be either upward or downward in the program. As I illustrated, there are forces that are increasing the cost, but simultaneously ones that are decreasing the cost. And I don't think this committee would want to find itself in a situation where, by putting certain things in statute, an increase in the Pell Awards meant that, again, we had general fund dollars available for student aid that could not be spent because they were prevented by limitations in the statute.
Representative Edwards?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to associate myself with the comments made recently by Senator Walker. As many, if not all of you know, I am a market research-based consulting firm in my private life. We do projections for estimating demand for commercial products. This is not dissimilar from what I do by profession. The number and variety of variables here is considerable.
yes.
I would be highly reluctant as a legislator to put in statute specific numbers associated with the total population served, as well as perhaps the amount of awards granted to students in particular situations. Rather than engage in that kind of micromanagement, I would humbly suggest that we consider putting together a statement of principles to guide the Commission's decisions in changing parameters. For instance, we could decide as a subcommittee that we want to ensure that the students with the least means to attend school are made whole, regardless of the number of students who apply. And so we may put together a statement of principles that kind of guides the Commission's decisions if they have to change the parameters based on changes in the student population.
Right, and I don't think, well, at least from my perspective, I don't think the idea was ever to come up with specific dollar amounts, but to do just what you were talking about. So,
next, Senator Devlin's
had and then Representative Jensen got passed over too. So, Representative Jensen, and then.
Okay. Just so quickly, I certainly agree with Senator Edwards on this, and I do think with the number of variables that we have here, it's a pretty much of a jigsaw puzzle as to what we're going to get, and it can change as any one of those variables change. And I think the legislature is not the place to be adjusting to all of those changes that might appear, but the commission itself is the place. Now, I think there's a very legitimate sort of approach for us as a legislature to provide the direction for the commission. That is, maybe something in the line of what we're doing here, or what the bill is proposing, or it might be something so simple as to just say something like this to reduce the number of students. I, however, would be resistant to the idea of reducing the number of students. That is, having a cutoff date, and if you don't make it by then, tough luck, sort of thing. Though I do understand that system worked for some time, and at the loss of perhaps some students in the process. But that would be the route, I think, Mr. Chair, that I would kind of like to go. To provide some sort of a framework for the commission to work with this, because the variables are too, and while we can get some pretty good good estimates, you know, they're going to be between here and here, and without having it in that sort of a gap, I don't think that we have the infinite wisdom. And no disrespect to LFO or to anyone else, you know, here on that, I just don't think we can get that precise with the amount. So
thank you, Senator. I would echo actually Senator Walker's comments, but I'd add on to that that if my memory is correct, in the OSAC budget, we added some budget notes asking really for extensive reporting back. I wouldn't have any problem with sort of a preamble language, but at this stage of the session, I don't think any of us are thinking at a constitutional level. Or
aren't you voting on something?
That's different issues. But the other thing was, is it goes to Senator Morse's question. And it's probably a question for you and for the commission. The only circumstance under which students that were formerly eligible under this system that would no longer be eligible would be if you had to reduce the income levels below where they were for the existing system. You don't imagine ending scenario under which you would reduce the income levels to the previous levels.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, in none of the scenarios that we've run have we seen anything that would push us to such a conclusion.
You might drop to, some of these you might drop under 50, but you wouldn't drop down into the lower levels that you were under the existing system.
Mr. Chairman, again, is that multiplier affects things. It's not a multiplier against a cut in the grant. It's instead a multiplier against the contribution from the family. And so it's not as deep as what I at least initially when I first thought about the concept, and then when I was actually working with it in the tool, I realized, oh no, this works in a very different way than what I thought, and it doesn't have the severity that I first thought it might.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would refer you to page 4, lines 26 and 32. The language anticipates that there may be modifications and changes in the total amount of monies awarded, and if that occurs, the methodology will change. So we're anticipating that in this bill. My question would be, given the risk that we have, is this language adequate to bring back to the Legislative Assembly those changes in a timely way before we have extended ourselves beyond the point of no return?
That's exactly the point that I was wanting to make. I think that because we have the second year of the biennium is the field that we're going to be working in time-wise. And what I'm not clear on is, so the agency goes out and advertises a program that looks like this. And they get a whole pile of applications that come into them, and they find out that there are, I think the potential here is for about a 27% funding shortfall. So they find out that they have 27% more requests than they have funding. So that, I assume, would happen at some point before the 08-09 fiscal year happens, but I don't know what the time frame would be between when that realization would be made and those numbers would be set, and you had to actually notify people and send out the grants. Can you give me any clarity around that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, historically the Commission has tracked the number of FAFSA applications filed that show student eligibility on a weekly basis throughout the application process. So the federal machinery turns on at the beginning of January prior to the coming fall academic year. families start inputting the required financial information. That information is transmitted weekly to the commission. They're then putting that through their own calculations in order to determine what we think the eligibility is going to be. They've done that historically because they had to decide when they were going to execute the cutoff dates. This year they've not had to do that, but instead we're using it as a way in which to try to monitor and estimate how much demand there's going to be, given that we don't have cutoff dates overall in this fiscal year. It'll be important as we enter the new program because, again, we're trying to gauge the amount of demand, where students are choosing to go. There are a number of different variables, and students may make different school choices based on the changes. So these things will be tracked throughout the process, so we'll know on a weekly basis how different that looks from what it would have looked like in the previous year. So there will be even time in which to report mid-summer prior to the start of the academic year how it looks.
Okay, you're describing a process to me, and I was asking for some points over time. So what I'm trying to figure out here is, what is the time frame between when OSAC would know whether the amount of grants is exceeding the money that they have and the time they would have to start awarding the grants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, they would have to make a series of assumptions about the students who applied, because right now we know what students... historic pickup rates have been who filled out FAFSA forms throughout the year. We're assuming that those are going to be a little bit higher, about 5% per sector, than what they've been in the past. If when September arrives and we have a 10% increase in the students who have chosen to go to school, as opposed to only the 5% that we forecast, then the commission will know that they've got a shortfall. And that would be for students who are already in school, if they choose to go throughout the full academic year. So there will be ways in which we can estimate based on what our history's been, but when we make this many changes, it's hard to say how valid those historical markers are going to be in the new situation. We're using them as really the only benchmarks we have, but some of them are going to change, and some of them may be countervailing pressures, and they neutralize each other, or they may not. I can't predict that. We'll track it very closely. That's one of the important things that we'll need in order to manage the risk in this program, is to develop effective tools so that we're tracking and we're sharing with your staff where this is going and how we think it's going to shape up.
One follow-up.
Sure.
This is making me increasingly nervous. I hear that there are no hard and fast timelines. You have no plan in place for what you're going to do if problems arise. You're just going to kind of take it as it comes and make decisions on the fly. And I think that is not really engendering of a lot of confidence that this program is actually going to work. And I'm wondering what you can give us. I mean, where do we go with this? Do we just say, have it and do good work? Or,
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, we think that the program is going to land pretty much right where it's forecast to be. We will be tracking that very closely throughout the application process. If we need to make a correction because we see more activity than what we expected in the FAFSA filing activity, we'll do that prior to the start of the academic year. And we'll report that to the legislature as well, so that you're aware that we've done that action in order to provide a safeguard. So that will be a proactive change prior to students starting school.
So if you were to make a change because the number of applications exceeded your projections, what would that change be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that would probably be to increase that progressive rationing tool that we multiply against the expected family contribution.
So what you're saying then is that you would increase you would increase the amount that should cut off the top end of the awards, basically.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that would happen with the top end of the awards, and then it would reduce those higher award amounts more than those for. It would reduce the smallest awards the greatest percentage and the largest awards the least percentage, because families with a zero EFC would have no reduction in their grants.
So why would you choose not to limit the number of students that were eligible and maintain the size of the awards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, at that point in the application process, the people who would be most impacted by that would be students in community colleges, because the FAFSA filing activity is uneven across the post-secondary education sectors. And in fact, the cutoff dates, when the commission had to use cutoff dates, were staggered based on the point in year in which that particular sector met its target. And the community colleges cutoff dates were in August, whereas the cutoff dates were in March for the independent colleges and the U.S. system. So it'd be a very disparate impact.
This is good. Lots of questions. We don't have a lot of time. In fact, we're out of time, but I want to go to Senator Morris, because you've been waiting for...
I'm not sure what...
Go ahead.
Senator Dillon was prior, but just to put it into context, anytime you have risk in a business enterprise, you have contingencies that you provide for. You actually plan for the contingencies. If we are remodeling this Capitol building, we think it's going to cost $35 million, we would have a contingency of at least 10%, more likely 15%. And I'm wondering if in this model it would make sense to think about funding it, let's say maybe a 90% ramp up, leaving some contingency funds to see how this thing evolves, so that you're going at it from, instead of going full bore and then having to withdraw and pull back, go at it with a program that you know confidently, high degree of confidence, is sustainable, and then you can build on beyond it. Because if you have students, even though they're in that middle income, and they're anticipating a certain level, they're in a career track, and then all of a sudden, you can't depend on it, that's not good. And I would rather be more on the conservative side, and if there's some way to reflect that, a contingency factor, it may get at this whole issue, but we don't know. I mean, we all believe this is a grand plan, but there's risk, and how you manage the risk, that's really what we're talking about.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, we could take the numbers that we have in the existing appropriation bill and run the scenario so that you could see what that would look like if we set aside $7 million out of the $70 million. That will have a pretty dramatic effect on awarding, but we could show you what that would look like.
Senator Devlin. Aren't there really, in a sense, so many variables in this, going back, that really, almost to get the answers to the questions that we want answered, and we'll have that year before the program starts. We'll see the FAFSAs that come in. We'll see what our enrollment is in our institutions, both public and private. We will not be making any actual awards till sometime, I would guess, in the spring. They will not actually be receiving any funds till probably at the earliest, sometime in late summer.
August.
Yeah. And that's when we really actually will have a fair picture of what sort of position we're in. I'm just wondering, under the current system, which is new in itself, because we, for the first time, no longer had cutoff dates, This is kind of a curious question, and we had the situation where fewer people utilized it than we thought would utilize it. How many of the awards were actually known at the beginning of the year versus how many awards came in for people entering winter term and spring term or spring semester?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I don't know the percentages right off the top. But trans generally, we have more of that incoming population in the community college system in winter and spring terms than what we tend to see in the four-year institutions. The four-year institutions tend to drop the number of recipients as the academic year progresses.
So if we give a scenario, did we have as much part-time usage as we anticipated this time when we opened it up part-time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, yes, we did. But it was about the same number each term, but there was a fair amount of change in who would comprise that number each term.
So, I mean, there's so many variables here in the sense of do this broadening potentially increase the part-time usage? Do the part-time students, some of them now elect because it's more possible to become full-time students? I mean, I don't think that you can get absolute answers. To be quite honest, I don't think you can get absolute answers more than a year before you actually give out the first check.
But I think the whole idea here is that is really contingency planning. Do we want to put forward, as Representative Edwards said, principles, or we would prefer that you err on the side of, you know, cutting off more students? I mean, that was kind of the idea of having this conversation. Representative Jensen, you get the last question because we're...
Thank you. And it's not sure whether it's a question or something of an observation.
You get the last piece of wisdom.
And as I look at this, we talk about, you know, we've talked about a number of ways to try to balance out or make dollars come out. But we have a concept or principle that this whole thing was built on. That's the idea of the Oregon Shared Responsibility Opportunity Grant. And I therefore submit that if we cut off the top end and don't do proportionally the same thing throughout the thing, the whole concept of the shared responsibility now has become distorted. Mm-hmm. It's shared responsibility with some type of a sliding scale as to how much your family makes or you make or, you know, something. And the curve is no longer really a linear curve that you're having with it, and so you're going to run into a problem, Mr. Chair. You're going to have to rename it unless it's kind of even across the socioeconomic or the economic range, not social that folks have, and I'm back again with the point that I think the responsibility of doing it has to be at the commission level. I don't think we can do it. I think we can provide some guidelines, and we can provide what we want to have happen and what we don't want to have happen with it. And go from there with it.
Thank you, Representative. So, Steve, before we adjourn, can you just tell us what's... Because we do have an idea in terms of the calendar. We don't know what's going to happen with all these college students and all of that. But we do have some idea of where we're going here.
Yes, Mr. Chair. You have two special meetings this weekend, Friday and Saturday.
Special.
Well, they're not. They're normally scheduled meetings. Tomorrow you have a meeting for a public hearing on Senate Bill 4, which is a bill to address nursing shortage. And then on Saturday, you have three K-12 bills on the agenda. I did not bring that information with me, but you have all received emails with information on the bills and the timing of those meetings. So please, if you have any questions after looking at those emails, please get back to either me or Darren relating to the K-12.
And we come back to this, 334.
Well, likely on Monday, we can talk if you want to vote earlier.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, then the intent is the only bill that's up tomorrow is SB4.
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen.
And I have no idea the complexity we're going to have on this before, but in light of the fact that everything's relatively fresh in our mind, that I would kind of like to come back to this tomorrow if we have the opportunity, if we can't reach a resolution in time after we get through or before we begin SB4 on it, we can still come back on Monday with it. Use our time as best we can, I guess, is all I'm suggesting.
I don't know how SB4 or how...
I think we could, Mr. Chair, I would recommend adding this to the agenda then for Friday, and I think there'd certainly be enough time to get back to this to some degree. I think that from listening to what the committee is saying, I think it might be helpful for me to give you some kind of list of things that I've been hearing people say, and you can indicate whether you want to basically require some things, prohibit some things, or just leave it to the commission.
I think that's a great answer.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you all very much. And with that, close Senate Bill, or excuse me, close the public hearing, Senate Bill 334, and we are adjourned.